Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we're having a very important show, one I'm actually looking forward to, because in the course of my practice, I've come full circle where I've now realized that nutrition is one of the underpinnings of health. And I see a connection throughout my practice with people who come in with chronic disease states like depression, anxiety, diabetes, high blood pressure. And what people are eating is driving, I think, a lot of their problems. There's a connection that people don't think about, and I alluded to it a second ago, and that's the gut and our mental health, how we feel in terms of depression and anxiety. And there's something called the GAPS, I don't know if it's a syndrome or a state, but it's a gut and a psychology connection. And today we're going to speak with someone who is well-versed in this, somebody who has, I think, personally had an experience and has expanded her practice and her what she does for a living to help people. And we're going to speak with Ms. Jennifer Scribner. She is a functional nutritional therapy practitioner, a certified GAPS practitioner. She trained under Natasha Campbell McBride, and her specialty is helping people learn and follow the GAPS diet to address chronic problems such as autism, complex digestive issues, and autoimmune conditions. She's also an author, and she's written several books. One is From Mac and Cheese to Veggies, Please, How to Get Your Kid to Eat New Foods and Picky Eating Forever, and Stay Sane in the Process of the Navigating GAPS Daily Journal, 90 Days of Tracking Patterns and Progress on the GAPS Nutritional Protocol. And you can find what she does at bodywisdomnutrition.com. And Ms. Scribner, I want to thank you so much for joining me today, because I think our conversation is one that doctors do not have with their patients and patients don't know a lot about. But I think if we could come together, we can do wonders to improve the health of ourselves and our country.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for having me as well. And this topic is so important to me because I feel like people don't really understand in our culture how our physiology works and how we hear the cliche, we are what we eat, but we don't really understand deeply what that means.
I would agree actually completely with what you just said. So I'd like to start from the beginning. This is something that's not a lot of doctors know about, not a lot of people know about. How did you come to really learn about this and specialize in it?
When I was in nutrition school, I heard about the GAPS nutritional protocol, and I heard so many success stories, particularly with children with autism and people who had a lot of digestive issues. And so it was just kind of circling around my education in the first place. And you know, when you graduate from school, you feel like you don't know enough. And so you automatically want to learn more and take extra training. And it just so happened that Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride, who is the originator of the GAPS protocol, was starting to train other practitioners around the world. And so I was able to enroll in her training program. That was just a few months after I graduated. And I didn't intend it to kind of be my specialty, but since I was one of those first of the group back in 2011, people just started seeking me out because there was this desire to have more kind of guidance and understanding on how to implement this protocol. And things just kind of took off from there for me.
Well, I remember when I first started practice, I saw children with autism and developmental issues. And one thing was always a problem was their GI tract, constipation, diarrhea, bloating, horrible appetites. And, you know, it seemed to me that there was a connection. Is that connection the thing that underpins GAPS? I mean, what is the GI side of this? Do they not have enough enzymes? Is it the diet itself that causes a trigger? What's the underpinning? I'm just curious.
Well, GAPS stands for gut and psychology syndrome and gut and physiology syndrome. So it's all about the connection between the gut, the brain, the gut, and the rest of the body. Because as we intake food and as we digest food, that's what gives us the raw materials for everything that we need in the body. And so there can be functional digestive issues where we aren't making enough stomach acid, we aren't making enzymes, and stomach acid triggers so many things kind of down the line. I always talk about north to south digestion. So we may have a symptom in one area, but what was supposed to happen before that, that didn't, that's causing this disruption. And many of our children, it's so common that they have reflux as babies, that they have issues with food sensitivities, even sometimes while nursing, that they may actually have things like low stomach acid from the beginning. And then it can also be related to disruption of our gut flora, as far as having not enough good bacteria, having bad bacteria, having weeds kind of growing where it should be a really rich and robust microbial community. And there's a lot of factors that lead into that, that can be being born by C-section, having antibiotics at birth or soon after. It could be just disrupted flora from mom as they were, you know, came through the birth canal, that they just didn't get seeded with the healthiest flora to begin with. And then often that leads to further interventions, whether that be through antibiotics, whether that be through other medical treatments that continue to cause disruption. And then we wean our children onto grains when they don't have the digestive enzymes to properly process those from the beginning, rather than what would be the more traditional foods like egg yolk and organ meats and meat stocks, these type of things that are correct for our physiology, but we've just been kind of led away from in our mainstream view of food as just filling some sort of void rather than really helping the body develop to its most ideal expression.
So all these shortcuts that we're taking with antibiotics and processed foods and all these things that people do out of convenience, they may actually may be making a situation worse from what you described.
Yeah. And that's something I talk about a lot with my clients, because it feels very inconvenient in our society to cook our own food. You know, we've been told that there is a shortcut, processed foods, just go to Costco and throw it in the microwave. And yet we end up having, either with our children or ourselves, chronic health issues, whether that just be, you know, the never ending, you know, colds and flus and allergies and reasons that we get called home from work because our kids are sick and that type of disruption. Or it can be as severe as needing special therapists or learning disabilities or, you know, any number of things that really takes a lot of time, a lot of effort. And then if you think about the lost energy, the lost vitality, the pleasures that you're not able to engage in. And so for me, I look at it as when we are supporting our body for its best physiology, yes, it takes some time, but you will save so much time, especially in the long run, on trips to the doctor, medications, therapists, you know, not being able to participate in athletics or events that are really, you know, interesting to you. So it's sort of trading one type of convenience for maybe another. And I feel like the balance is really in living a more kind of holistically minded and food, like real food-based lifestyle.
I would absolutely agree with that. Let's take our first break because I want to delve deeper into what you just described about our beginnings and what we should be thinking about. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Jennifer Scribner, and you did a really wonderful job of speaking about birth, you know, what we do when we're children. And I've seen children who really can't tolerate their diet, you know, milk, they're on soy, they're on these various formulas because they can't, their GI tract can't stomach, so to speak, stomach it, for lack of a better way to put it. But if you start from the scratch, is it better? I mean, maybe it's a general vague question. Is it better for the mom to breastfeed? Or if she can't, what kind of foods from an infant out? You know, you just said that children should be eating things like egg, but at the beginning, what should we do to try to set the flora properly? properly?
Well, ideally it starts before birth with the mother's diet, the mother's flora, getting in good balance as well. And so that can include things like eating fermented foods, naturally cultured dairy products like yogurt, sauerkraut, pickles that are naturally fermented versus the vinegar kind. So things that have healthy probiotic microbes can help set the stage for that. Those are things that get passed on through the birth canal when the baby's born, if there's a natural birth, or they're also passed on through nursing. And so it is ideal to breastfeed. There's so many reasons for that, that are, you know, the physiology of what happens within the mother's milk actually changes based on communication from the baby's saliva. Like, it is so much more complex than we used to think. When formulas were invented, and yes, they can be necessary, but as far as the nourishment that comes through nursing, it's so much more than just a set of macronutrients, you know, fats and proteins and carbohydrates. It's more than just a couple of nutrients. There are probiotics, there are immune factors. You know, if the mother is exposed to something like an illness, then she's going to make antibodies that are going to pass to the baby, and that's going to help train the baby's immune system. So there's a lot to that that makes it ideal, in addition to just the physical act of nursing helping development of the jaw, the vision, the connection and bonding between mother and baby. So that's always going to be ideal. And I really encourage people to find ways to support that in their life, because our culture doesn't always support that. And we really have to advocate for that.
I had
when
no idea.
When that's not possible, the next best thing is, go ahead.
Oh, no, I had no idea it was that complex. Sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a whole science that we're kind of learning more and more about as we get modern methods to like look at these different avenues for it. So the next best thing after breastfeeding would be making a homemade formula. And for this, I always refer to the Weston A. Price Foundation. They give recipes. They have guidance on making formula from high quality raw milk and other ingredients that are as closely matching a mother's milk as possible. You know, again, it's kind of like cooking our own food. You're always going to get a better result when you're making it yourself, you're making it fresh, you're using the highest quality ingredients. Beyond that, it really can depend on what formula may be tolerated, and always looking at organic, always looking at the highest quality. I can't really recommend any particular, you know, baby formula, because none of them contain the saturated fat that we actually get through a mother's milk, that we can get through a raw milk formula. And that's really crucial to the brain development. So that's always sending me back to making formula, or even potentially finding another mother's milk that you're able to purchase or share, if that's available in your community. And that can be an option for people as well.
That's important to know. So when the children are diagnosed with reflux, which is one of the major diagnoses throughout age, you know, whether it's infants, children, or adults, there's this knee-jerk response to put them on an antacid. You just described the condition of low acid in the stomach. How would this exacerbate that? Does it lead to more dysbiosis? Does it stop people from digesting their food correctly? What's the consequence of lowering the acid the acid too much?
Yeah, stomach acid is crucial in digesting food. And most people, it's, you know, overwhelmingly common that when we have reflux, we actually have too little stomach acid versus too much. And when we lower stomach acid further, we create an inability to properly digest our protein. Because that's what stomach acid's for. We want a nice low pH because that breaks down the protein. And then as the food then leaves the stomach and enters into the first part of the small intestine, that low pH is also what triggers the release of our digestive enzymes and our bile that digest our fats, our carbohydrates, the rest of our protein. So we really set ourselves up for maldigestion all along the way if we are reducing stomach acid versus getting to the root of why we're having reflux, which in babies and adults alike is often food sensitivities. We're eating things that our body is kind of rejecting, that it isn't suited to, or we just have poor flora in the stomach itself, potentially. You know, we need to look at these root issues. It could be an alignment issue that may need to be addressed through something like chiropractic. There are many different kind of avenues to look at that versus the symptom idea of, oh, that's uncomfortable, or, oh, you're having too much spitting up. Well, let's give this medication that stops it, rather than finding out why it was there in the first place.
You made a really good connection, because I have seen a connection between poor digestion and things like scoliosis. I'm never sure why that was the case, but it must be some sort of neurological pathway that's being inhibited. Is that how that works?
That's an interesting question. I've never really thought about scoliosis, but what comes to mind is that, you know, our minerals are always going to be attached to different things. And so we need to break those off of the food that they're a part of for them to be digested. But the other aspect of it is that fats are the cofactor for mineral absorption into the body. So if we have disrupted stomach acid and that's disrupting the release of bile from the gallbladder, then we're not properly digesting our fats. So therefore, we're not going to be absorbing our minerals appropriately, even if we're eating them. Mm-hmm. They're just not going to make it across the digestive tract into the bloodstream to be used where they need to be. And this is something I see a lot in adults who have, you know, thinning jaws, that they have osteopenia, is that especially when they've been on a low-fat diet or they, you know, had a gallbladder removed and so they're not digesting fats well, that they will end up with these more mineral deficiency kind of diseases later on, because things have been so dysregulated for so long that the body really just can't get what it needs to build appropriately.
One thing I've also noticed, if your mineral level is low, then you're more likely to not be able to balance your acid and base. So you become pretty acidotic, and that leads to inflammation. And also, you're right, osteopenia, and I've seen and read that if your body needs it, it's going to take it from the bone. So you're actually just, you know, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, but you're ultimately just setting yourself up for these chronic long-term diseases. Now, from the standpoint, you mentioned, you know, how we take in our fats. And I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but a patient told me that her physician told her that she shouldn't take probiotics because they're useless, or digestive enzymes. I know we're going to take a break in about 5 minutes, but I would love to know your take on that statement.
Well, it really depends on the person. And I don't think that everybody needs to take enzymes or probiotics at all times, but I look at what is going to build the bridge to better function in the long run. So I would love it if people are eating probiotic foods, if they're tolerating probiotic foods. So if you can eat sauerkraut, if you can drink kombucha, if you can tolerate yogurt. Some people can't do that from the beginning, because of the state that their health is in, the state that their gut is in. Maybe they have a lot of histamine type issues. So eating fermented foods actually aggravates that symptom until they do more healing of the gut. And those are the cases where I would say, let's, you know, choose a particular probiotic capsule that you take for a while that helps you start repair the gut so that you can tolerate these things down the road. Same thing with digestive enzymes. Maybe you need that stomach acid repair before you can make your own digestive enzymes. And so you want to take that as a supplement for a while to help you reduce something like bloating, to help you, you know, have better overall digestion and assimilation. But these things, to me, the way I use supplements in my practice is always, how do we restore function so that we don't need them in the long run? I kind of almost feel like supplements are like medications, where, yeah, maybe short-term use, but not a long-term crutch, because we're always wanting to get back to, how do we support this with food? How do we allow the body to do what it naturally does? Because even supplements were very recently, you know, invented. Mm-hmm. And so there are ways to get all of these things through food, but most people are not knowledgeable enough or even necessarily in the correct physiological shape to just restore that very quickly through basic changes. Often there's, you know, a deeper thing that needs to happen first.
I think you're really just drilling down to, you want to fix the problem and not just treat the symptom. And you're talking also about taking supplements as the same principle, not as bad, obviously, as taking a prescription medication. But the body is self-healing, do you think? And if you just give it its building blocks, it will do what it's supposed to do.
That's absolutely what I've seen. And what has led me to believe that is just through this work. And we're told so much in our society that the body is, you know, about to get us. It's like going to break down. It's, you know, we're just steps away from falling apart or being attacked by something. And we've forgotten that we are made as self-healing, you know, just as all other creatures are. And it's really funny when we look at things like even with our pets. You know, how often do you need to intervene on a pet if they have a sneeze or something like that? It's like they're very self-healing. Yeah. And we are too. But we're somehow talked out of that in our culture. And we can remember that and we can relearn how to do that. And to me, that comes back to that understanding, supporting our physiology through real, whole, natural foods, and also regulating our nervous system, getting our body into a calm state where we're not all anxious, we're not all freaked out, we're not on this hamster wheel of stress every day, so that the body can actually relax enough and have a little bit of time that it can start the self-repair process, because it's not in that state. Mm-hmm. If we're running every direction, if we're way overloaded, it's in this, you know, fight or flight mm-hmm. or stress hormone state that's counterproductive to healing. So food is absolutely a huge foundation of that. But in my experience, so is kind of setting the stage for that to be utilized by taking a few deep breaths, getting a little bit more sleep, maybe saying no to something every once in a while, so that the body can actually be supported energetically to start that healing as well.
I think that's a beautiful place to take our second break. Let's take that. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Jennifer Scribner. And again, you can go to her website, bodywisdomnutrition.com. And before the break, I think you did a wonderful job of thinking about the body as a whole. If you're in a fight or flight mode where you're anxious or angry, then cortisol takes over. And doesn't that inhibit really quality digestion? Because it's all about getting you moving as opposed to keeping everything in balance.
Yeah, and that alone can be one of the reasons why people may have, you know, low stomach acid or digestive issues, is that when we are in that state of cortisol, that state of stress, the state of kind of hyper arousal, the body doesn't really feel like it needs to work on digestion, because it is putting all the energy into the brain and the limbs to figure things out, to run, to flee, to kind of problem solve, versus that restive, digestive, procreative type of energy mm-hmm. that, like I said, is conducive to healing. And so just on a stressful, you know, day or a stressful week, you'll feel that in your own body. I mean, everybody has had that experience where you're all keyed up about something and you can almost feel the constriction of your midsection, like you're hunching in on yourself, or that your stomach is clenched. And so, of course, you're not going to be in a flowing, relaxed state, if you even just kind of envision how things should move through the digestive tract in a bit of a flow. You can see where you're like kind of squeezing that off inadvertently, but that's the effect that stress can have on us, on our, you know, just physically.
Well, that can, I can see how that's now interrelated then to the diseases that we're starting to see, things like a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and various irritable bowel, either you've diarrhea, you've got constipation, autoimmune disease. I mean, there's a lot of things that go on in the gut. And one of the things that people, again, I'm not sure they think about is anxiety, depression, how you mentally feel. Is it true that more of the, I don't know if they're receptors or things that control your mood, are actually more in the gut than they are in the brain?
That is true. Yeah. When it comes to neurotransmitters, and this is something that there's a lot of confusion about, especially after SSRIs, you know, antidepressant type of medications really were invented and became popularized in the 1990s. The research showed that depression is not a chemical imbalance in the brain. It doesn't mean that antidepressants don't work for some people, but what's really the root of this issue is in the gut, because that's where 90% of your serotonin is made. 80% of your dopamine is actually made in the gut and stored in the gut and shipped off to work in the brain. And so when you are correcting digestion and you're getting in the raw materials. So the physiology is hormones, neurotransmitters are made predominantly of protein, fat, a little bit of minerals, some water. So if you're not getting those raw materials in, if you're not digesting them, you don't have the basics to build these things, to use them appropriately. And we see this so much in our culture because we eat so many refined foods, so many carbohydrates, and it's not just about getting a couple of vegetables to get these nutrients. We really need the fats and we really need the proteins. Ideally, these are going to come from animal sources because the brain contains so much saturated fat and cholesterol. There's a cholesterol as part of the cell membrane for every single cell in the body. So if we're avoiding that, we're going to end up with issues with our mental health and with our hormones in the long run.
So things like testosterone, estrogen, they're also the same building block, are they not?
Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of that is in the gut as well. You'll hear it referred to as kind of like the estrobolome. It's like, you know, estrogen and the connection between even our sex hormones and what's going on in the gut. Because remember, it's like they may have a organ that they are associated with, that they're used by, but all of these things originate through what we're eating, how they're created, you know, the raw materials that are coming through the gut.
So when you really think about how many medications that people are taking for lowering their cholesterol, and I would say when I was in medical school and residency, what was considered to be normal is now high cholesterol. It's amazing how they've just lowered the numbers dramatically. So if you're taking medicines to lower your cholesterol and you're, gosh, eating a diet, and I would love to ask, my secondary question is about the diet. But we're basically taking ourselves off balance every time we put one of these pills in our mouth as if it's disease, but it's actually needed. And isn't there a connection between low cholesterol levels and your mental like dementia and your mental status, your memory, your function?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that people often run into when they are on cholesterol lowering medications, where they start to lose some of their overall, just that overall vitality, mm-hmm. where they start to have issues with memory loss, where there may be issues with even sexual dysfunction, because the cholesterol that's needed to make the sex hormones is so lowered that there isn't enough to go around and that the body has to start cutting corners. And we'll see this in all different areas of vitality. And so there again, when we look at high cholesterol, and I agree, you know, looking at over time, the high level has been lowered and lowered, and there's so much more complexity to that. But when you're looking at, you know, the reason that people will have cholesterol or high cholesterol jump up in a short period of time, again, it's that treating that symptom rather than looking at what is the underpinning of this, what is the underlying root issue that's causing this cholesterol to be high or imbalanced. That's how I will look at it. And I have a very different view of cholesterol than the Western kind of paradigm has. But I'm looking at things like, are the triglycerides high? Because that's our refined carbohydrates showing up as inflammatory products versus the overall cholesterol. And so being able to kind of look at that more holistically, look at other markers, and then see, where is this inflammation coming from in the body? Is it coming from the diet? Is it coming from exposure to toxins? Is it coming from an infection mm-hmm. that is now being overlooked because all we're doing is suppressing cholesterol rather than looking at what are the roots of this? We need to go deeper.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think the bane of healthcare, if you want to call it that at this point, is evidence-based medicine, because it's always about giving you a medication to treat a specific symptom without regard to what the corollary is. What does it unmask? What does it mess up in terms of your balance? And then I see people on medications for the side effects of medications that they're taking. It doesn't even make sense. And just a second ago, we talked about depression. It makes now perfect sense to me that you see these commercials for these antidepressant medicines, and now they have a second one because the first one really didn't work. But the bottom line is you're trying to boost the amount of serotonin, dopamine, or whatever in the system, but you're not making any because your gut is messed up. I mean, it's just like it's like whack-a-mole almost, isn't it?
Yeah. And this is what people will experience. You know, I think it's the average 40-year-old is on 4 medications.
So sad.
And these are things that are chronic. And from what I've read in the literature is that doctors have a really hard time taking someone off of a medicine that someone else prescribed. So sometimes they might even feel like, maybe you don't need that one, but they don't want to, I don't know, like hurt another doctor's feelings or something by looking at what really they can be removed off of. And of course, there's very little study of what these things do to interact with each other. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. even if this drug has been tested, it's not tested with these 4 other drugs. And what are the long-term ramifications of that? And what are the potential side effects and toxicities that are building up, that you take one thing and that leads to constipation, and then you take something for the constipation, and then that leads to, you know, something else. And so it's just a spiraling that people get into, and it's so hard to know how to get off of that kind of treadmill and off of that spiral. And to me, it comes back to, how can we just take a couple steps in the direction of real food, of cooking a little bit, of getting our lifestyle to be supportive of our physiology. We don't need to change everything all at once, but there is a path back from that type of paradigm.
I agree. So I know we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I want to start the conversation about diet. There's so many things, be vegan, be paleo, whatever, I mean, Mediterranean. Is there such thing as body type or blood type? Should people be eating a certain diet to augment what's good about their system? Or is this just, you know, I wouldn't say a scam, but it's just a fad to try to make money?
I mean, I think there can be clues, and there are things that can be helpful for people, especially if you feel really called to experiment with one of these plans. Like, try it, see how it works for you, and take what works and leave the rest. I don't like people to get too locked into any one thing forever. And just because something works for a while doesn't mean that it is your forever plan either. And so I really encourage people to think about physiology, and humans are one thing. We all have physiological needs. The structure of our body is made out of protein, fat, and water, and some minerals. You know, carbohydrate type foods contribute some micronutrients, but they are not what our bodies are made out of. So we really need to think a lot more deeply about, how am I created? What is it that I'm made of? And really return to those type of foods predominantly. And then I also encourage people to see how it makes you feel. Keep track, you know, make some notes in a journal, find out, how is that working for me? Give it a shot for, you know, 30 days, 60 days, and see what really is a big win for you. See what feels supportive. See when you feel lighter, when your mental health feels better, when your hormones start coming back online. And some of these things can take a while. You know, if you're working on mental health, if you're working on a nervous system condition, you've really got to look in like a 6-month cycle to see what are the changes, because it takes a lot longer to kind of switch out those cells than it does to say something like your blood sugar, which can change in 90 days because your red blood cells are renewed roughly in that period of time. So this type of experimentation is always going to be the gold standard. There are all sorts of perspectives on what humans should be eating and fads and seasons that might work for you. But ultimately, it comes back to your lived experience and figuring out what personally works best for you.
I think that's good. I mean, it's about the individual instead of one size fits all. So let's do this. Let's take our last break, because I would love to go into more detail about, we talked about food, but what about our environment? So let's take that last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living a Solution. Again, we're speaking with Ms. Jennifer Scribner, and I think we're getting a wealth of information about how we should think about what we put into our mouths. And it's very complex, but one thing is easy. You have to take the time, and you have to want to care about yourself. It's not easy, but it's worth it. I mean, there's no more wealth that you can have than your health, I think. And you're giving us the nitty gritty on why we want to do things. Now, before we talk about our environment, I'm curious about sleep. Is there a time frame? Obviously, most people, I counsel patients with reflux, for example, not to eat less than 3 hours before bedtime. But is there some golden time frame that you should really end eating because the body needs time to really do what it needs to do?
At least 2 hours before you're going to sleep. And you'll feel the difference of this. Even I myself used to eat really late. I would come home from work, I'd work out, I would eat dinner at the 8:30, and then I had to get up early, so I'd be in bed at 9:30, and every night I would lay in bed and kind of have a little bit of a stomach ache. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I switched my routine around that I realized that, oh, I was trying to digest while my body was onto its more detoxification cycle that should be happening during sleep, and that I just needed to kind of put things in order. So I think it's best to eat earlier, but again, experiment and see what works best for you. And often you need to think about what works best for your body, not just for your culture and your obligations, because there can be a big difference. You know, so many of us are running around with the kids or meetings or activities every night, and that's why we're eating late. And maybe we need to question some of that and reorder ourselves so that we can live in a higher expression, so that we can feel better overall, and see how that shifts what you're available to do on a daily basis. That can really change, but it requires some personalization. And the other thing I think about this is, before electricity, which wasn't invented all that long ago, people weren't eating many, many hours after dark. So you'll notice some seasonality in how your digestion works as well. You know, when it's summer and the days are longer, you're probably going to feel okay eating a little bit later, versus when it's the short nights of winter, you'll likely feel the difference when you're eating at 7 p.m. versus 5 p.m. more than you do in a time like the summer.
Should you vary the amount that you're eating? Some people eat their heaviest meal, for example, at lunch, and they have a light dinner. And, you know, depending, I guess, on the culture too, is there any benefit to changing that?
I think that there is. And I like to view it like, you know, we're fueling up for the day rather than stuffing things in for nighttime when we aren't going to be as active. And ideally, we'll have our highest kind of digestive fire when we wake up in the morning, that we should be hungry within an hour of waking, that we should want that tells us that we have kind of good stomach acid, good robust digestion, is that we will want to have something, we'll want to put some fuel in, and then we're going to expend that during the day. And then that may get to smaller meals throughout the day. But that's also something that's worth experimenting with for, you know, by a person as well. Mm-hmm. And I'll also say that sometimes people feel like they want to eat more at night, or they need something a little bit after dinner because they haven't really been attentive with the meals that they've eaten earlier in the day. So if you are able to eat, you know, your breakfast and your lunch undistracted, you're not on social media, you're not listening to the news, you're not working, you know, it's not kind of chaos around you, but you're actually taking a few minutes to be with that meal, your brain is going to connect with that satisfaction. You're going to digest better. You're going to absorb more because your body was like present for this experience. And that can help with some of the like lessening the need for a large meal or a lot of snacking that people tend to in the evenings as well.
And in terms of drinking with your meal, water, alcohol, what do you recommend? Some people are saying that you should drink your water not with the meal because it might dilute your enzymes. I've heard all sorts of things. What's your take on that?
Yeah, my take is that if you're drinking, you know, water, non-nutritive type of drinks, that they should be not with the meal. That can kind of water down stomach acid if you're having, especially, you know, a water by itself that doesn't have minerals in it and that type of thing, that's more likely to just kind of flush through your system than really be a source of nutrients and nourishment to the body as well, which most people don't think of water that way, but I really do. I feel like it's so integral to the body that it's its own kind of nutrition. Mm-hmm. If you're having something that is like a soup or, you know, some type of liquid in your meal, that's not going to cause the same type of issue. But it, I do recommend that people drink their water a bit before their meal. And one interesting thing about stomach acid is that even though it's very acidic, it's still predominantly made of water. So I like people to think of having, you know, some water a half an hour before they eat so that that raw material is in place before the food comes in so that they have plenty to kind of fuel that stomach acid in that way too.
I like that. And also you probably feel more full, so you eat less, no?
Yeah, it could be. And I will say when people get into that, they want something, they want a snack, but they aren't really sure what it is. Nothing sounds really good. Often that is actually a sign that they just need to drink some water, that the body's sort of craving some hydration. And so that's a time that I encourage people, you know, have a glass of water, put a little pinch of natural sea salt in it so you get some minerals, a little bit of electrolytes there, and then give it 20, 30 minutes and see if you still need something.
That's a good rule of thumb. Now, we talked about what we put in our system, and we might have to, I would love to have you back on to really go into this in detail, but I want to whet folks' appetite. What we use to clean our environment, chemicals, and let's say you have a problem with mold exposure, and I see that a lot because we're in the South. Let's start with mold, because that's one of the major players in a lot of folks. Is that a thing that can affect your GI tract, your mentation, your mood? What have you seen anything with that toxic mold exposure example?
Yes. It's funny that you're asking me this right now because we've actually just been going through mold remediation in our bathroom in our home that we found that was some mold growing in our flooring. And when we took that out, it turned out there was some in the walls as well. So this is something I've recently been very educated on personally. But I've also worked with it with a number of clients because when people have ongoing exposure to mold, and there are many types of molds and not all of them are extremely toxic or dangerous, but it is really important to know if the type you have in your home might be, and it has to be removed because it puts out mycotoxins that can be so disruptive that you will either become chronically ill or that you just won't be able to heal, even when you feel like you're doing all the right things. So in my experience, people who have something like really bad eczema, bleeding eczema, people who, you know, have another chronic condition, maybe it's something like Crohn's disease, and they really try all the dietary things, the supplements, like, you know, cleaning up the environment as far as not using toxic cleaners, that type of thing, mm-hmm. they'll only get to a certain level and then they'll plateau there and they just can't move forward until mold has been addressed. And mold just can't be cleaned. I mean, you got to clean it in the moment to try to like lessen your exposure, but it has to be removed. And it's definitely a process and it can be a real hassle. And I know people fear even looking at it like we did because it can be costly and time consuming, but it just creates so much problem in the long run. It's sort of like what I mentioned earlier, you know, the convenience. It's very inconvenient to deal with mold, but it's also very inconvenient to deal with the long-term health effects of chronic mold exposure.
Agreed. And it's so subtle. I'm sure people end up in all sorts of different specialist office. I had a patient who had mold toxicity and she looked like she had Parkinson's. I mean, she couldn't talk. She couldn't walk. She was on a cane. It was amazing how it just affected her entire life. And then she had to move, get rid of everything and be detoxed of the mold exposure. And she's now working again. So, I mean, these subtle things, people end up with just this vague diagnosis or no diagnosis, and they're just treated and tested out the yin yang, but they don't really, people I don't think know a lot about mold. And again, unless you've experienced it, you wouldn't. And time goes way too fast, but I would love to have you back on because I want to talk to you about the house, you know, what the cleaning agents are, how we can actually take control over things that we're exposing ourselves to, but we really are not sure how toxic they are. So I would love that if you could.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that. That's definitely a whole, you know, show's mm-hmm. worth of conversation as well, because there's so many facets to it and there's so many things that you can change. And the thing I will, you know, say today is just one change at a time is additive. You know, the lifestyle that I came from was totally standard type of lifestyle. And the way that I've changed in the past dozen years is vastly different, but it's been one thing at a time. So don't look at the totality of what you feel like is the ideal lifestyle. Just look at that one cleaner or look at that one food and find something that you can swap that is better, that is simpler, that is more natural. Because one step at a time and integrating that into your lifestyle is what creates a whole new life for you. And it's what makes it sustainable rather than trying to radically change everything all at once, which can be hard to just keep up with. And that can create its own stress.
Agreed. You don't want it to be overwhelming. You want it to be, you know, a positive in your life. Now, in the minute that we have left, how can people buy your books? And if you write any kind of blogs, I'd love for people to know how to reach you.
Yeah, people can contact me through my website, which is bodywisdomnutrition.com. I have many blog articles about the GAPS nutritional protocol specifically, and some things about general nutrition, non-toxic home. My books are both listed there. You can find my book, From Mac and Cheese to Veggies, Please, also at Amazon. The journal that I've written for tracking the GAPS nutritional protocol is a printed journal that's available on my website as well. And then people can always follow me on Instagram at Body Wisdom Nutrition as well for additional tips and updates. And I even have some stories saved about my mold remediation for people who are curious about that or are have that coming up in their life too, the things that we have discovered and what we've learned and kind of tracking our process there.
Well, I want to thank you for joining me today. I'm looking forward to having you come back so that we can have a part two about our toxic environment and how we can eliminate it. So again, thank you so much for joining me. It was an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you. I've really enjoyed this conversation too.
Well, thank you. And thank you everybody for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.